Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate, and everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program.
But even if you're out of debt, you're still going to have those taxes and property and casualty insurance that you're going to have to pay, and you really don't know exactly how much they're going to go up over time because it's outside of your control. If you happen to live in an area that everybody else wants to be, supply demand is going to drive those home prices up, and the government's going to, you know, raise those taxes as time goes along.
Hey, everybody. So glad to be back with you here. Chris Martinson of Peak Financial Investing, also peakprosperity.com, back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hi, Paul. Good to be here again with you.
Yeah. Good to see you again today.
All right. So where do we pick up again? This is Finance University, so we're going to talk about things financial. And there's a lot going on out there. So, you know, there's a lot of concern that the United States is spending about $500 billion a month now. It isn't taking in quite that amount, right? And all of this has been funded so far. You know, stocks keep floating up, Bitcoin's going higher, commodities just get crushed or don't go anywhere for some weird reason. Inflation just came in hotter than expected on a most recent reading, which sent stocks down for a day. And, you know, so there's still, the point is there's still everything's floating on a very large sea of liquidity. Financial conditions are very easy, as we've discussed before. So there's concern, though, that this liquidity flood is going to be ending soon. A lot of this is the byproduct of the 2020 largesse. The Fed printed $4.5 trillion for its balance sheet. The federal government's deficit spent $2.5 trillion of that in a single year. And just to lift everything, right? And we had stimulus payments. We had PPP loans that never had to be paid back, all that, right? So that was just a flood of money. And a lot of that, where does money go? It goes into the banking system. What do they do when they have excess reserves? They put it back at the Fed. So that pile has been getting whittled down, and there's concern that that whittling is over around March, end of March. So the question is, I think a lot of people are asking, you know, is there a risk in the markets? They look bulletproof, but as you and I know, they're really just a gauge of how much liquidity is out there. Can we talk about that liquidity for a minute? You know, where you see that going and how you read that?
Yes. Yeah, so from a liquidity standpoint, what we are seeing, there's a lot of individuals that are doing a great job warning about the March deadline when that liquidity comes down. What's the Fed going to do? You've got behind the scenes the commercial real estate situation, CRE loans that are really blowing up across the board. But behind that, you have a backdrop that nobody's talking about the fear of a recession. 6 months ago, everybody was talking about a recession that just never happened. Now nobody's talking about a recession, but yet during earnings conference calls, corporations are talking about laying off employees more than what they have been in the past. So there's a ridiculous amount of complacency out there. And the belief is that I believe the market participants are just believing that this liquidity that's out there is all we need to keep the markets going, that the Fed's going to step in and save the day, and that commercial real estate issues and the, you know, the bank liquidity drying up and those reserves drawing down and the end of the BTFP, the Bank Term Funding Program, is no big deal. That the worst is behind us, then everything's going to be okay. So quite frankly, you know, the momentum in the markets has been so strong for the past 14 or 15 weeks that it's possibly going to carry through for a while. That's a possibility. It's not outside the realm of possibility that it surprises everyone and turns the other way. But yeah, I mean, it's like there's no concern in the markets whatsoever. They're just until yesterday. And that concern lasted for, what, a day? VIX jumped 7% yesterday. And last I looked a few minutes ago, it was down 4%.
Yeah, no, it didn't even last a whole day if a day is 24 hours. the future started marching north again soon as everything was closed again. You and I have talked about how this is sort of a global equity market, and that and they're all kind of behaving the same. So this isn't really a story about U.S. technology or all that. The Japanese market, the French market, the German market look the same. The German market, they just had an announcement out that they're also facing just a legendary bust in commercial real estate, like worse than they think than even the great financial crisis, which was at heart a real estate crisis. So yes. That's saying something. And boy, their stocks just aren't even like, just again, no concern, just sort of perched right near all time highs. And so that complacency is really strong. And if I had to get, I see people talking about it openly now and they say, I'm complacent because I'm pretty sure that the central banks are just going to bail us out. They have to. So they feel like the central banks have no alternative. The TINA, there is no alternative, T-I-N-A. They feel like they're caught in a TINA situation and they're just going to play that game. Can't argue with it. It's been true for years now.
No, it is true. And another thing to point out is the fact that corporate stock buybacks, one thing about the liquidity and easing financial conditions, it allows these corporations, and I don't agree with it in the long term. I think what is in the early 1980s, it was outlawed that you couldn't buy back the stock. I know there's purposes for it, but the way it's being used now, there's always a seller on the other side of that. So somebody is selling large amounts of stock back to these corporations, and that provides demand under the surface to drive these higher, and especially from an index standpoint, they're price insensitive buyers. They really don't care. They've got liquidity, they've got money, they want to put it to work, and their hope is that the Fed's going to bail them out if things start to wobble.
I've never been a fan of the stock buybacks because it's at very simply, the corporation, if they want to give money back to stockholders, we have a mechanism for that. It's called a dividend, right?
Right.
Second, but first, the first order of a company should always be, I have money. What's my highest use of this? So by distributing it, however you do that, you're saying, I don't have a better use for this, which is fundamentally sort of, I think, taking a little bit of a dump on your business plan, right? It's like saying, we can't figure out any way to spend it productively within our business environment here. So, no more property, plant, equipment, employees. We don't need any of that, right? Mm-hmm. But that whole idea that this is giving back to the shareholders, can we just disabuse people? Can we just get rid of that concept? Because that's what a dividend is.
Yes.
If in too many of these companies that I look at, Paul, what actually happens is they award huge amounts of stock options, which are dilutive to the C-suite people, and then they have to buy them back, So it's really when they say, a stock buyback is for shareholders, a lot of those are actually to pay off the C-suite. giant amounts of money. So that's how I see it.
I do too. And what Charlie Munger stated, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. So when the largest majority of CEOs, the C-suite compensation is through stock price appreciation, right? They've got a vested interest to reinvest that capital back into purchasing those shares. Yeah, it may increase the earnings per share on the books, but I agree with you. Pay it back to dividends to your investors. That's rewarding those investors across the board. And then take the remaining amount of capital and reduce your debt level so that you're in a position to expand parts, expand. If you're not going to put it back into assets and building buildings and manufacturing capability or purchasing your supply line up through the chain, then give it back in dividends or pay down that debt. But that doesn't necessarily help the stock price as much, which is, again, an incentive that I believe has been distorted for the benefit of the management class.
Well, it's all fun and games while things are expanding. But when you get to the recessionary part, that's when you find out these same companies, they would like to have more cash on hand sometimes, Then they have to reverse the whole process, So it's basically a buy high, sell low strategy. And when you run it that way, I don't think it's a good use of, I think it's a misuse of the CFO position and the treasury function personally, but that's an editorial opinion. I guess a lot of people don't seem to care, but I do,
Well, I do too, but there's no fear of debt levels. There's no concern about debt. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're buying back shares, but instead of paying down debt, you know, there's no fear of debt on the government level. There doesn't appear to be any fear of debt on the individual level. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of individuals that are forced into debt, whether they're the cost of living's going up because of their lack of earning capability. But there's just no fear in these markets right now. I mean, the government has so intervened to keep us from having a recession that, mm-hmm. that people are trusting, foolishly so, because at some point they're going to lose control and things are going to get bad. And only those that are diligent and disciplined enough to stay prepared and have a risk managed strategy are going to be in a position to benefit from that on the other side. Benefit second, protect themselves first.
Yep. I'm going to just share this one thing with you real quick here. Let's see. I think it would be this one. So when you talked about debt levels, right? So this is from the Fred St. Louis site, and this is all sectors, debts, loans. This is just loans, debt outstanding. So this is TCMDO, Total Credit Market Debt Outstanding is the series. Mm-hmm. Look at this. You see this number? 96.8 trillion. Like, we are closing in on the magic triple-digit number on this whole thing, right? And by the way, this is an almost perfect exponential function to rise up through here, right? With this one little wiggle, which I keep making the point, that wiggle almost destroyed the world. So that's the great credit, you know, financial crisis where debt just went backwards for a little bit. Like, if you were a household, Paul, and you said, oh, you know, I used to have $50,000 in credit, debt, and auto loans kind of combined, but I managed to pay that down to $40,000, people would go, oh, good for you. There's nothing wrong with debt going down. Kind can be a good thing. But in our system, that almost wrecked the whole show. So they got it going again, you know? But that's amazing. We're about to hit $100 trillion of debt here. And I just think that's astonishing.
Goodness gracious. It is astonishing. And you know, I would love to see an overlay between real median incomes in the United States and percentage gain increase compared to that debt level, you know, and our GDP increase, you know, it's mm-hmm. the debt's expanding a lot faster than our ability to pay it back.
Yeah. I mean, it's just how it is. So, I mean, it can't continue forever. So, and everybody kind of knows that, which is why, you know, I've stayed away from politics a lot. This isn't a political statement. I couldn't possibly be more disappointed with both parties saying, you know, we'll just put another $100 billion to foreign countries, you know, to mostly to blow stuff up, right? It's not like we're putting $100 billion out there so that they can have better farms or improve their canals or do something amazing with it. It's like, nah, here's $100 billion to blow stuff up, you know? It just, we can't afford that right now.
No.
We just can't.
No.
But we're acting, that complacency is like, you know, what's $100 billion? I'm old enough to remember when that was a big number, you know?
Right. Right. Well, my question is it complacency? Is it pride? Right? Do we have the pride mm-hmm. in our leadership within the country that we're bulletproof, that nothing's going to happen, that the rest of the world is not going to make a move against the U.S. dollar? And look, I get it. There's no perfect alternative to the U.S. dollar. But again, human nature and human nature expands to a national scale at point. If the pain of changing is easier than the pain of staying the same, then people are going to go through the pain of changing. And it seems that the rest of the world is finally really starting to whether they're going to change in the sooner rather than later. They're certainly looking for the exits, trying to find another alternative, because at the path we're on, they just can't put their faith that we're going to operate by the rule of law and just basic morality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those sins will catch up with you eventually.
Yes.
You know, and one of them, you know, sloth, right? To be lazy. I always thought of that as sort of an admonition against just sort of like not doing physical work, but I realized that actually it there's a laziness of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad, right? Mm-hmm. Like you got to put the thinking in to really understand where we're at and what's going on and all of that. You know, I mean, that's my work in the world. I'm trying to, mm-hmm. I just don't understand how more people aren't just fascinated by the big world things that are happening and things about energy policy, how much money is being printed. I don't know. It's like there's a almost a like there's an aversion to it. You know, it's strange. So here's a strange thing. When I've been over, every time I go over to Europe, like last time I was in Iceland, or when I've been, you know, say in Germany, people there, it's amazing. You go into a bar and you can find people who will talk about almost anything, politics, philosophy, science, you know, like there's no, like, they won't look at you and go, oh, you're not one of those geeks, are you? You know, like there's almost like this enforced pride of ignorance, you know, that happens a lot here that's astonishing. So I'm actually glad to see more people waking up and saying, you know, time to get involved. And when I gave that presentation with you at the FLCCC meeting there, and it was about the economy, you know, a lot of people showed up because they want to know, right?
Yes, they do.
They want to know. So I think that's a good thing.
Well, and I think people have gotten to the point, and especially what happened in the aftermath a couple of years ago is of the big C word, it finally started to awaken a larger part of the population. And what I'm discovering in the conversations that I'm having is people are more willing to listen now for those who are courageous enough to talk and treat them with kindness and just have a debate. That's something that we've not had in the past, you know, agree to disagree, but let's talk about the facts. Let's not, you know, attack each other personally, because we're all Americans, regardless of what your political stance is. We're a part of this country and we have a responsibility to make sure that the future of this country is in great shape so that we can pass it on down to those behind us and give them something better than we received. You know, one of the things I taught my kids is if you ever borrow something from someone, be willing to pay for it, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you borrow it, it may not be your fault, but it can break, and return it in better shape than what you received it. That's just being a good steward of the things that you've been given. And, you know, so I think people are reaching the point, but Chris, I think a lot of it's just, they're caught up in the busyness of life. I mean, you know, I know I talked to a lot of people in our industry, some friends of mine, and just government regulations are coming down. You know, Renee was talking yesterday, says it's amazing how much time we spend now versus what we did just 6 years ago of just filling out papers, just pushing papers. And if you're good at what you do, you're busy. Right? I mean, because there's just not a lot of people with the work ethic today that they've had before in the past. So if you're good at what you do, you're busy. And then people are getting home and they're just wanting to numb out. It's easy to watch the television. It's easy to, you know, get on Instagram or Facebook and talk all day long and skin deep level without getting into anything that's substantive in its or substantial in its conversation. And they're just cruising through life and they haven't had enough pain yet. They've had some fear, but they've not had some pain yet because the government's been able to bail out the economy and postpone these recessions for so long now.
Well, you know, when I lived down in North Carolina, because that's I was in a little town called Pittsboro, and this is when I was going to Duke, so I was there 7 years. This was through the postdoc as well. And I lived at the end of this road called Alton-Alston Road. And Alton-Alston was the patriarch. All these black families lived on this road, and then us, you know, down this driveway. And they were poor, very, very poor. And the place was immaculate. Like every yard was crept up. And that was my first experience, you know, living in a place, because I came from New England, where if you were poor, that equated to decrepit and dirty and shabby. Like it was just an association. It took me a while to realize what was interesting about this. But these people had pride and they were proud of, like, they wouldn't live around squalor. That was not who they were. Right. So, you know, I looked at that and then I realized, you know, if you go to Japan, you could go to a city that you've never heard of probably, right? It's not one of the top three or four cities or something. And it is clean as a whistle. You can eat off the streets, right? You know, everything works. It's amazing. And then every time I come back to the US, I'm like, this is kind of looking shabby, right? It's like we've lost our mojo. We've lost our pride. We don't even know how to keep stuff up anymore. To your point, maybe these are the pencil pushers. And like when we were down in Panama, you know, there's a huge bridge going over this river. And, you know, we took some shots and it's interesting and it's got a whole story. But we asked this construction supervisor, like, how much is this going to cost? I'm thinking it's $100 million. He said, oh, about $6 million. It's like, what? You couldn't even get one of the concrete footings in America for $6 million.
No way. No.
You know?
Way. There's that much extra cost built into the process here versus there. That's amazing.
I didn't even know how you could get the steel for that amount of money. But anyway, maybe there was a translation problem and he missed a zero. I don't know. But the interesting thing is every time I come back to the U.S. from a foreign country now, I have the same observation, which is, wow, this is shabby. Potholes, stuff falling down, you know, and we're sending $100 billion to somewhere else. And, you know, it's just, I think it's time to admit that we have a problem. We have a leadership problem and that we have to turn inward for a while, and we got to work on ourselves before we get out there improving the rest of the world. Know what I'm saying? Maybe we should.
I agree. Examine the log in our own eye before we talk to somebody about the speck in theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to an extent, the incredible amount of wealth that we have been given from the generation before us, from the sacrifice and the discipline that laid the foundation for the U.S. to be in the position that it's in today, has created, you know, what I see when I talk to a lot of younger individuals specifically, and even individuals my age. I'll be 50 this year. A lot of individuals that are my age are just living for today. They're not thinking about the future. You know, it's all about trying to impress, you know, I wish I could remember the quote now, buying things that they don't need to impress people that they don't like, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the game that we're into today. So that's part of the society. And then you've got another part of the society that's just been left behind. You know, jobs, good paying jobs have been shipped overseas. That's gutted the labor force, not the labor force, but the manufacturing capability inside the United States, because it's just a lot more profitable to do it overseas when we were in this globalization. So you've got a whole section of our society that's just been left behind. They don't have the earning capability to keep up, but yet they're presented on Facebook and Instagram and, you know, all of the social media sites that this is what will make you happy if you live this way. Look how much fun I'm having because of the way I'm doing, you know, the way I'm living. And I think it's causing people, because of lack of fear of debt, to put themselves at the greatest amount of financial risk that, quite frankly, I have seen in the 25 years that I've been doing this just from an individual level. And I think I've got some charts here that we can show.
Yeah, show that one on median household income to house prices, because that one's instructive, right? And so
yes.
One of the things that I'm...
There we go.
Yeah, look at this. What is that? That is a dead patient on the bottom. That is a flat EKG. What is that?
That's the real median household income in the United States. So it's not the average. It's the 50 percentile inside the United States. So that's the median, which you can kind of take as the average.
And real meaning it's been inflation adjusted, so we don't have to wonder why it's been flat for all those decades. It's real meaning that's...
Correct.
Yeah.
It's inflation.
Not nominal.
Yes.
Yeah, so, yep, inflation adjusted. Hasn't changed. On an inflation adjusted basis, flat line. Okay. What's the top line?
Yeah. So the top line is the median sales price of houses inside sold for in the United States. So in 1991, the real median household income was $59,710. The median sales price of homes sold in 1991 in the United States was $120,000. Okay.
Wow.
So if you jump forward till today, well, I say today, this date is at the end of 2022. We should have the 2023 data come out before too long. The median sales price for a home sold in the United States was $433,000. And yeah, the income has gone up from $59,000 to $74,000. But that's only a 25% increase in the real median income, while the median sales price of a home has had a 260% increase.
Wow.
260% increase. That's incredible. Chris, that's really just asset price inflation across the board is what it is.
So, Paul, it must have been back in 1980, houses didn't have roofs or something, right? No front doors?
No.
They've gotten a lot better, I guess, you know,
Yeah. I mean, we've got a little bit more technology, but I mean, quite frankly, you know, that the office building that I'm in here, was built in 1956. And the only thing that I had to do was I gutted the interior to turn it into an office. I upgraded the wiring and I went from a fuse box to your traditional, electrical panel today. And then I replaced the windows. right? Like the brick is still here, you know, the flooring, but the structure of this home is built far better than any of the houses that are built today. Just because, you know, purchasing power was a lot greater back then than what it is today.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, but I mean, think about that. So to your earlier comment, that this idea that, you know, people are finding it harder to keep up, or, you know, more and more people are falling behind, or we just don't seem to have that same vitality we had before.
That's
well,
right.
I understand it because in my own small town, right, people are getting, and I'm not casting aspersions on my town or any of its leadership, but this is the dynamic that's happening to people everywhere in this country, right? Mm-hmm. It's a common thing. People are getting taxed out of their homes, right?
Because yes.
The value of them goes up and up and up, but, you know, it's the same home you were in before, but now some people are, you know, my taxes on my home mm-hmm. are more than my first rent checks used to be, right? So I'm basically renting now from my local government, right? Like everybody is to that extent, right? But on the local government side, all their costs have gone up through the roof just to get salt and snow plows and fix the potholes and. So the prices of everything have been going up. And then, of course, as you and I know, and most listeners here will know, the government has been lying about the true rate of inflation for a long time.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's the probably the most common conversation that I have with individuals across the board. And, you know, I had someone walk in here recently, retired a long time ago, thought they had more than enough assets. The year 2000 basically scared them. They retired in 2002, so they put it 100% in CDs, thinking that they had enough. Well, you know, CD rates crashed as well. You know, they went from 5-6% down to 0 to 1%, but their car insurance, what, last 12 months went up 20%, I think it was, somewhere around 20% on average. Their, you know, because of the property value increase, their home, you know, their taxes have gone up, their property taxes have gone up substantially, and their home insurance has gone up substantially. So they're having to make some major decisions.
Yep.
Because they've fallen so far behind and they've just about waited too long to make a decision. But they finally came to the conclusion, if we don't act now, you know, if we live longer than what we expect or live as long as we'd like to, we're seriously going to be in trouble. And that's the worst part about it now, Chris, is, you know, even if you get out of debt free, and I'm an advocate of getting out of debt. Retirement is a lot easier for those individuals who have no debt when they go into retirement. They sleep better at night, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But even if you're out of debt, you're still going to have those taxes and property and casualty insurance that you're going to have to pay, and you really don't know exactly how much they're going to go up over time because it's outside of your control. If you happen to live in an area that everybody else wants to be, supply-demand is going to drive those home prices up, and the government's going to, you know, raise those taxes as time goes along. And we're fortunate here in North Georgia that they're very reasonable compared to the rest of the nation. I'm shocked on a consistent basis about what taxes people are having to pay for the value of their home across this nation and in certain states.
So when I'm, you know, those insurance bills, they never seem to make it into the government statistics. And when I interviewed Paul Butowski of the Chapwood Index, where, you know, he's got a very simple methodology, he's been doing it for 15, 20 years, I forget how long time. They just go to 50 top cities and they take the same 200 things and they put them in the basket every year and they ask the question, what's inflation, right? And the answer is it's at least two, closing in on 2.5 times higher than we've been told, which is a big deal. If it's 7% instead of 3.5%, well, as you know, that means instead of my money getting cut in half every 22 years, it gets cut in half every 10 years. It's a big deal, right? And so how you have to plan for what inflation really is. And part of the reason he has this big gap is because of insurance. He counts tax, local taxes, and he counts insurance in there, which just get, they don't count that. The BLS, when they're counting inflation, they do something called owner's equivalent rent, where they call up homeowners and they ask them, hey, if you were going to pay yourself rent, how much would that be, right? And they get this answer, and I'm suspicious, Paul, of the answer, because allegedly they call 60,000 households every month, right? Mm-hmm. So that's 600,000 households every year, right? Out of 140 million households in the U.S., I've never met somebody who's received that phone call. So statistically, I just know the wrong people, right? Have you ever gotten that phone call? Has yet BLS ever called you up and asked you how much you'd pay yourself in rent if you had to? Which, by the way, you're not the right person to ask. You shouldn't ask a homeowner. What does a homeowner know? You might be calling somebody who's lived in their home 50 years. They're like, I don't know, $12, you know?
Well, if they really want to know the answer to that, what they need to do is call business owners that rent their building to themselves, because their CPA is going, no, you can't rent your building to yourself for five times what the market is. It's got to be what the market will bear. So,
or
no,
just go to Zillow.
Yeah, go to Zillow. That's right. I've never had anybody, I've never received that phone call, nor do I know anybody that has received that phone call either. And I've got a pretty large footprint here across the Southeast and really nation.
Yeah.
Connection. So no, I have not. There may be somebody in the audience out there that has, and I'd be curious to know if that's the case. So,
well, so what do we, but what, so how do you help people? I mean, if inflation is twice as high as we officially tell ourselves, because we're a nation that likes to gaslight ourselves, like, how do you even begin to plan for that? Because that's a big number. That's a hard number.
It's a big number. So that's a good question. So in our retirement plan analysis, and that's one of the things that I really go through, that's so important to educating people on what they're going to face when they get into retirement. You know, we'll use a 3.5% compounded inflation. And I've used that for a long, long time, even when numbers were much lower than that 3.5%. And then we'll stress test people at 5.5% and at 7.5%. What I have seen is if you've planned for that 3.5% to 5.5%, 6%, at least over the past 12 to 15 years is which what we've planned for people, that's been enough so that they can maintain their standard of living, because it does shift to an extent. Once they get into retirement, some people typically spend a lot more in the first 2 years when they get into retirement. They've got a lot of pent up demand, and then It settles down some. But it's hard to plan for, you know. That's one thing. I have so many individuals that'll come in, and instead of using that institutional questionnaire, right, that says, tell me how you would like to be invested. You know, and what I have found in working with people is when the market is really bad, right, at the bottom of 2008, at the bottom of the 2000 collapse, you know, during COVID, depending upon what the market goes down on the day, people will score a lot more conservative than what they otherwise would be during some euphoria. My argument is what we have to talk to people about is, I'm not doing my job if I give you exactly what you emotionally want to have. I need to show you the facts of what you need. Mm-hmm. And then you only carry as much risk as you need to be successful. And then you have, you know, if inflation starts to eat at you, you make some changes. The hard part, Chris, and this is the really hard part, there is no conservative way to protect yourself against inflation, because the cost of living adjustments gained in the government's favor. So it's technically a hidden tax when your Social Security doesn't go up as much as what the real cost of living is. That's not honest, right?
And not honest.
It benefits the government to the expense of the individual. And people forget that Social Security is an entitlement. I mean, it's an entitlement, because it's not something, it's not welfare. It's something that you paid into the system for. You are entitled to that because you set aside a tax and your employer set aside a tax so that you can receive those funds. And the government has a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that they're managed and your income is increased at the actual cost of living. And that's what frustrates me so much about the consumer price index being gamed in the government's favor. Look, I get it. Yeah. It's a business that's doing it, you know, for some of their numbers, right? Not for their retirees, but the government is supposed to be, you know, the ultimate fiduciary for their citizenry. And that's just not taking place. We've got too many.
That's why I was laughing, because you said They're supposed to manage that with a fiduciary responsibility. And I can't contain my laughings, because remember, Al Gore was like, the lockbox. We're going to sort the lockbox. Even back then, that was a lie. There's no lockbox. Hello, people. There's no money in the Social Security Trust Fund. No. There's a bunch of IOUs. And this is Enron-style accounting. Like, people, oh, no, those are special treasury bonds. Like, wait a minute. So one branch of the government, this would be the subsidiary that's offshore in the Caymans, owes the parent company, you know, money. And they've one of them's recorded that as an asset. Like I've shipped you my cash and I'm recording that as an asset. It's an intra-governmental holding. Intra, not inter, intra. So that's exactly how it's, I mean, they tell you straight up, this is an intra-governmental thing. If you tried this as a private company, you get in trouble. You know why? Because it's fraudulent. It's illegal and fraudulent, right? Constructively fraudulent, right? If not actually. So, there is no money in the trust fund. They're a pile of IOUs. Yeah. That's it. Well, who's going to pay those IOUs off? Well, Chris, those are special treasury bonds. Okay. Who pays those off? The treasury. Where does the treasury get its money? From the same guy who's putting money into Social Security in the first place.
Yes.
It's a Ponzi scheme. It totally is. Like, yeah, like if they stopped, right, they said, oh, we're just going to terminate the program right now, right? Mm-hmm. There's no money in there. It's like what happens when, you know, Bernie Madoff, when the whistle finally blows, right? It requires more people coming in to pay for the people who already paid in because that money already got spent. And here's why. In 1988, they raised that Social Security tax, right? They doubled it. And Greenspan, in his fiscal wisdom, even though he's a monetary vandal, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, came out and said, oh, yeah, this should fix it in perpetuity, right? Turned out to be transient. And so then they had all this extra money flowing in for a while, and the government said, well, why don't we just roll that into the general obligation fund? We'll just spend that, mm-hmm. and we'll put these IOUs back. This is, to your point, this is immoral. This is immoral. It's really, and so when you said they're supposed to be managing it with a sense of fiduciary responsibility, mm-hmm. This is fraudulent behavior.
That's right.
If you're not the government who sets the rules and defines for itself what it thinks is fraudulent for itself, but for you and me, it's clearly a fraudulent behavior.
Oh yeah, I mean, my license would be completely removed if we dealt with client resources the way that the government deals with the citizenry resources. Now that reminds me, you know, a lot of people wouldn't know this, and I was actually shocked by this. So what I did was I went to the usdebtclock.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty interesting website, and it's scary to watch how fast those numbers are rolling over. You think you won the lottery on a slot machine when you're in Vegas, when you look at it, and then you realize it's taking from you, not putting back in.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what this breaks down to is I just tried to break some of the page down to make it a little bit easier. U.S. national debt as of February 13th when I grabbed this, was, over $34 trillion and spinning along quickly. That's $101,812 per citizen. Okay. Which is $264,945 per taxpayer. So if you are a taxpayer, you owe a lot more debt than the one that is not,
And this is just federal debt, right? This isn't state, municipal, corporate, household, auto loans, none of that. This is just federal debt.
U.S. national federal debt, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Goes into the budget deficit, other data. Which, you know, going back to 1980, and this is what I was looking at some of the data, just going back how much things have changed since 1980, that was the debt to GDP ratio was 34.5%. Right. Hey, that's mm-hmm. in line. You know, you can go get a mortgage based on your income. If you're, you know, what the payment's around 30% or so, you can have that approved mortgage. Today, it's 122% of our GDP. So now, speaking of Social Security liability, here are these numbers, Social Security liability and Medicare liability. The total of those unfunded liabilities is what, 212 trillion, right? 776 billion, 13,454,910. Mm-hmm. This was shocking to me, Chris. I should have known
that. Yeah.
The unfunded liabilities per citizen is $632,829. $632,000 is what each citizen is on the hook for, quite frankly, an unfunded liability. So the government has the ability, oops, I didn't mean to jump screens. The government has the ability to pay that through its taxing power, through its citizenry. Now, if you combine the U.S. national debt per citizen, what we have in the national debt accumulated, and the unfunded liabilities per citizen, that gives you $734,641 per citizen is what we each as citizens of our country owe. And, thought pops in my head, well, what if they bring in a whole bunch of people through immigration, automatically make them citizens? That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be responsible for paying that debt with as much money as we seem to be giving them. But, you know, that's mind-boggling to me. And I should have known broken down in that manner, but it puts it on a personal level. You're a citizen, Chris. I'm a citizen. Our share of the national debt and unfunded liabilities is $734,000, right? That's insane.
Baby pops out, swaddled in its clothes. Congratulations, you have $750,000 liability. Starting life with that, right? And so even at, I was also going to say Alan Greenspan. Let me catch up with the times. Jay Powell on 60 Minutes the other night said, well, yeah, this is all very unsustainable, but more to the point, I'm concerned that it's incumbent on every generation to pay its own way, channeling Thomas Jefferson, right?
Right.
For him to be saying that, I think that's a not-so-silent dog whistle for people that they should be hearing. Your ears ought to perk up, you know, when you hear that, because he's basically telling us that this is unpayable. So the question then becomes, well, what happens if we can't pay it back? And our creditors decide to, you know, foreclose on that operation, right? So that's where we suddenly find out we're not as rich a country as we thought.
No, and I want to go back to that screen, but I want to ask, so when he makes that statement, I've always taught my kids, and this is the way I live, pay attention to what people say and pay attention to what they don't say. So the fact that he said that's a pretty big deal. The baby boomers are the wealthiest generation that, you know, alive right now. So does that mean that he's an advocate for clawing all that back from the baby boomer generation somehow? I don't know. What's your thoughts?
I'm not sure he gave us a sense of direction off of that, because honestly, the only way to do this honestly would be to live below our means for a period of time, because that's what it means to go into debt and live off of debt for a while. You're living above your means, right? So I could borrow $1 million tonight and throw lavish parties and, you know, blow it all on vacations and all that. And you're like, wow, you're living beyond your means. Later, when I have to pay that back, though, I will live below my means, because whatever income I have has to go towards that prospect. Mm-hmm. And so it bears noting that $1 trillion a year now on an average run rate is going out the door in interest payments alone from our prior partying that we didn't pay down or pay back.
That's right.
$1 trillion a year. Who's that going to, we should be asking, right?
That's right.
And a lot of that's going to our creditors. Who are those, right? Mm-hmm. To some extent, it's ourselves, to the extent people own treasuries. But when you really peel it back, it's going to a very small group for the most part.
It is a small group. So you may, I got to thinking, just a moment ago, you made that comment about where's that going to be paid from. So to pull this chart back up, or this data, what I didn't highlight before is in the green here. So these are the assets that we have. This is the small business assets. I'm not exactly sure of the calculation behind that, but the small business assets, the corporate assets, and the household assets, that gives a total U.S. total national assets based on their calculations, what, $188 trillion? Which is $561,000 per citizen. So even if we liquidated all of our national assets, then we couldn't set aside enough money to cover our U.S. national debt and our unfunded liabilities. Now, those unfunded liabilities are stretched out into the future, but unfunded liabilities, we don't have enough assets if we fully liquidated everything to pay off, to set aside enough funds to cover all of those right now based on this calculation.
And that is, again, that these numbers we're comparing is just the national unfunded liabilities at the federal level.
Correct.
What I showed before on that TCMDO chart from the Federal Reserve is that just debt alone, including this, $34 trillion, but all the debt in the United States, well, it's actually only marketable securities. So that $34 trillion includes, I forget what it is, $6 or $7 trillion of that is actually Social Security. So that's intragovernmental. That wouldn't show up in that other chart. But without making that complexity, nearly $100 trillion alone is just the debt outstanding, which this includes in it. So actually the numbers are bigger than this, right?
So this is just, this is not even representative of how big they are, correct?
Right. This doesn't include the Illinois teachers' underfunded pension program, the CalPERS underfunded retirement program for California. It doesn't include any of that or any pensions that may be, you know, underfunded, that such as they exist to a vestigial extent in corporations. But so when you add all that up there, you know, and oh, one other thing, all that infrastructure we were talking about, all those potholes, apparently we got like $4 to $10 trillion of just stuff we should probably be fixing so that we could actually be a world, you know, first world country again, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, one other chart that I'd like to show here, which is just, this is heartbreaking to me, Chris. It really is.
Ooh, what is happening here? This does not look good.
This is personal interest payments, and it comes off of Fred, you know, St. Louis yep. Fred Gordon. So in 1984, personal interest payments were, what, $71 billion, up to today, $563 billion. So this is individual personal interest payments. And look at that skyrocketing of that chart there with interest rates.
Wow.
So what that tells me, just the sheer skyrocketing is, and investors became, or not investors, consumers became complacent in their use of debt, you know, levered themselves to the hilt just in time for interest rates to go up. I mean, that really reminds me of, I think it was Mark Twain says, how do you go bankrupt slowly and then all at once, right?
Yeah.
But this is
interest payments. So again, this is because the Federal Reserve kept interest payments at 1% or mm-hmm. below during too many years from 2008 onwards. And mm-hmm. then they pulled the rug and all of a sudden they rammed them up to 5%. And that's what we're seeing here. So this is not necessarily people taking on tons more debt. It's the debt they have became a lot more expensive, right? So, you know, mm-hmm. before that line started to skyrocket, you could get a 30-year mortgage for just over 2%.
You could. You're right.
Now it's, you know, 7.5 or whatever it is today, but it's, you know, it's a lot higher. So yeah. Wow. That is a big deal though. So that's $250 billion a year now difference over the last 3 years in terms of what people are paying.
Yes.
Households.
Yes.
$250 billion in interest payments. Yeah. Nope. Yeah.
And so far, you know, and that's moved so fast that I believe that there's going to be a lag effect on the impact in the economy. And mm-hmm. of course, inflation numbers came out yesterday and give us an indication that inflation's not dead. The market panicked in the short run because they were higher than what everybody was expecting. So if we have inflation continue to, you know, if the base effects or any indication of where we're going to be going in this inflation does not go away like everybody's anticipating, how much does the individual have to absorb that substantial increase? Because, you know, I thought this was interesting as well. You go back to 1984, the personal savings rate in the United States was 11.4%. You jump forward to December of 2023, that's 3.7%. Okay. So,
yeah. And this one's interesting. This statistic is an average. And the reason I'm leery of this one is because the wealth gap in 1980 was totally different than today.
Absolutely.
So that 11.4% was a much tighter, that's a more representative average, right? Mm-hmm. And today we have like the 0.1%, their savings count in this, right? So I would be interested to see this statistic if you just took the top 0.5% off, because they skew this. They make it look a lot higher than it is. I'll bet you anything it goes negative, that people from the 99.5% range on down on average may have a negative savings rate just because that 0.1% or the 0.5% on the top end has such extraordinary savings, because the Fed prints money, throws it at them, and they can't possibly spend it all, so they save some of it. It would be interesting to see that broken down by even decile or quintile or something like that.
Your mind is so...
This is that average thing, you know, it's like they say, you know, like what does an economist say? If you have one hand in a bucket of lava and one hand in a bucket of ice water, on average, you're okay, right?
That's good. Chris, your mind is so brilliant, because that now I really want to know what that data has to say. And I'm going to go on there and see if we can just... I'm sure that we can pull the data that goes behind it to take a look at it. I'm curious about that. I'm going to do some research in to see mm-hmm. what that looks like. But, you know, if that is skewed from the average, which it makes sense that it would be, because, and this is the thing that's so frustrating to me, in every way the government skews the data to make it look better for them at the expense of the citizenry. Okay, it just does. You know, we've got that generation of weak leaders and weak individuals that are more concerned about their image than they are doing what's right for the American people. Mm-hmm. you know, and they're so short-term and instant gratification in their focus, you know, let's risk destroying the our ability to borrow and our creditworthiness in the United States just to make the markets look good into the election, right? So I'm curious to see what that data ends up being. But it's sad enough on its own. It's sad enough on its own.
You know, if that point I was making about the median versus average income for savings, if that's true, you'll see that in a some sort of a statistic like you had before, that chart that or graphic that would show how many months savings somebody or how many dollars savings a household might have, right?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Let's talk about that because I happen to have that data with us. So this is from a consumerfinance.gov Making Ends Meet in 2022 report.
Mm-hmm.
I found this information to be fascinating. So I did my best to recreate their chart, and I'm learning PowerPoint, so I'm a little proud of it, actually. But anyway, so how long could you cover your expenses using savings, borrowing, selling assets, or help from your family? Now, Chris, when I read that headline, I was like, seriously? I mean, even in this data, it's like, let's put as much out there. So using savings, going to borrow money, selling assets, or help from family, that's a wide range right there. And even with that wide range, 53% of our population under this survey and report, the study that they put in, has less than 3 months that they could cover their expenses. So that means they don't have enough savings, borrowing capability, assets to sell, or family with enough assets that can cover their expenses for more than 3 months. So that's 53% of the population.
Wow.
Now, 21% of the population only has 3 to 6 months. So there are good, 27% of the population has more than 6 months. Now, one of the things that I'm advising people when I meet with them right now is use these asset prices and this euphoria that's out there right now to harvest some gains if you don't have 24 months worth of your expenses in savings. Okay.
Yep.
And so what, you know, so what if it loses to inflation in the short run? Put it in treasuries, roll it over every 30 days, go to Treasury Direct. You can put that in there, but secure yourself, unlike these corporations that are buying back their shares and potentially foolish stewards of the funds that they have, and put yourself in a position to survive things if it gets bad, because that means only 27% of the population, and that would put you in a position to be with 27% of the population under this study to take advantage of the opportunity after first you survive and don't lose ground by losing assets, being forced to sell assets at lower price, or going into debt. But I mean, that tells us 73% of the population has less than 6 months to cover. And for those people who are relying, let's say it's an individual that's, you know, 27% of that's, well, hey, I've got a family member that's got enough assets to care for me. That may be skewed in that number too. 7 in 10 people that you go to look for to help you are just not going to have the opportunity to help. They're just not in a financial position. So our citizenry is not in a very stable as a whole in the country. There are individuals that are in really good position, but as a whole in our country, we are not in a good position as our citizenry to survive a recession if it comes. And the reality is we need one. We need one to burn out the dead weight that's in the markets, to get rid of the corporations that are surviving on credit, and have a solid foundation that we can build from going forward.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm just going to flash this up in place of my image here. And we've covered this before, but I want people to be ready for more inflation. I'm not surprised by more inflation. This is the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, showing just under current law, what kind of deficits are we going to have going forward. And this line right here is the $2 trillion line. And so you'll see some of these are a little higher than two, some are a little lower. So let's just say it's averages around two. That's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 trillion of new debt for the federal government, taking us out to 2034. Now, why is this also significant? Because, the CBO has also said that the Social Security Trust Fund is completely insolvent in the year 2033. That is to say, they've eaten through all of those special bonds, right? And now the government's going to have to actually throw in more. The government's going to be in the position of having to pay more money in just to meet the requirements of what they said they were going to pay out in that entitlement, right? And so I think people also need to be prepared for the idea that they're going to change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
If the government has to choose between building a new aircraft carrier or honoring its commitments to retirees who already paid into a system, I think we know we're going to get the aircraft carrier, right? Because
absolutely.
Just how it is. And editorially, if anybody from the AARP is here watching this, I don't know what y'all are doing, but you've lost the way. Like the NRA lost its way. The AMA lost its way. You should be advocating in Washington, D.C., for the people you allegedly represent, who you take fees from, and you should be getting in there and yelling about this now before anything else happens. But I don't know. I these advocacy organizations that take premiums and fees and pay big salaries to themselves and then do nothing also bother me.
they bother me too. And you know, and really all you got to do is work your way into the top of the organization if you have self-centered and evil intents, and turn it just a little bit in another direction to help you serve your capability. And unfortunately, that's what I see in a lot of these organizations. They're not serving their members anymore. They've been mm-hmm. hijacked at the highest levels. They are. Now, the Social Security thing is very interesting in that conversation. So several years ago, I took 2 weeks and went and had somebody teach me everything that I could learn about Social Security. It's not something that helps us make money for clients per se. You don't go out and, hey, I'm the Social Security expert, you can pay me to do that. But it's a toolbox that I have to help serve clients better. And believe it or not, there's 20,000 different ways, technically true, that a couple can approach Social Security planning together. In reality, there's about, I mean, that's technically true, but mm-hmm. in reality, there's probably a good 200 different ways that people can approach it. Now, in that class, they talked about, you know, the issue coming up in 2033, and this is their argument. This is what people are thinking about, and these people know the Social Security system better than a lot, anybody that I've met out there. In 1982, we had an issue, and at the last minute, we had a bipartisan agreement come together, and that was the extension by a couple of years of Social Security benefits from 65 to 67. Now, they've had a couple of changes here recently that did away with spousal benefits and things of that nature. What I'm concerned about, just in the little bit of calculations that I've done and looking at it, is at some point, you know, the argument's going to be, hey, we can't pay this, so there's going to be a means test, potentially. You know, if you have too many assets, you're not going to qualify for it. Or, you know, they you know, it's taxes go up again, or there's a whole group or generation of individuals that's bumped out to, you know, 77, 80 years old, if it's even there. And this is just positive thinking at this point. So when I meet somebody young enough under the age of 45, you know, my number one suggestion is, yes, we'll look at what Social Security is going to do for you, but you have to invest and prepare for yourself and assume that Social Security will not be there. You have to assume mm-hmm. that you are on your own, because when you have weak leaders, they're not watching out for you when they're watching out for themselves. So you have to be diligent to prepare for yourself, because it is your responsibility to prepare for yourself and make the sacrifices today and invest wisely to put yourself in a position that yeah, if you get it, it's a benefit, but something has to dramatically change. Something has to dramatically change. And unfortunately, it appears that's the legacy that the baby boomer generation is going to be leaving behind, is just a tremendous debt burden on the generations behind them. That's going to take decades to work out, generations to work out at this point.
It will. And you know, my concern, and I'm really glad to be working with you now, because at least we can talk about this concern and you don't try and poo-poo it or minimize it. But it's based on the Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises, who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, there is no means of avoiding the pain from a credit expansion. You either voluntarily abandon the credit expansion, that's what Jay Powell was talking about, or you face a catastrophe of the currency system involved. Those are your options. Either stop borrowing too much on your own, or your currency takes it in the shorts, right? I mean, that's where we're steaming towards, right? Nobody wants to have that conversation. And again, I think that's a sin, right? Like, we should be, like, We should be having a full-throated, realistic conversation about this and not go, oh, it's too complicated. The experts say, you're like, no, it's going bankrupt. What's our plan? Okay, how are we going to manage that? Hey, I don't think we should be undercounting inflation and stiffing the people who built this country. I think that's wrong, but even without that, I think it's fraudulent, right? Which, you know, to put it either in a moral or a criminal term. So that's where we're coming towards. And I'm kind of hoping that we can start having those conversations. I'm hoping that's where we're going, because I'm starting to feel it, Paul. People are starting to wake up and they're starting to get pissed off.
They are. Right? They are.
Because we were out here doing what we were supposed to be doing, living our lives, building houses, raising our kids, building businesses, contributing to the whole thing. We were keeping up our end of the bargain, and then we wake up and we find out the other end totally abdicated, not keeping up their end of the bargain. In fact, worse, they've been stealing from us. So I think people are starting to get, you know what? It doesn't have to be this way. We can do better. We've been better before. We'll get back there.
We can do better. And here's the, and you know, and one of the things we have to prepare for, and this is what we do, what I do for people, whether, you know, whether we've had the conversation about it or not, we're going to have the conversation in the future. But I have studied every hyperinflationary collapse that I could find, or fiat currency collapse that I could find historically. And okay, read journals and read books and try to discover how did people survive and protect their hard-earned savings from the foolish leaders that they had when they were in Germany. Mm-hmm. We have a unique situation as a U.S. investor right now. The U.S. markets have been the only game in town since 2008. Over that period of time, you've had what normally takes place with international countries. So, you know, if you're a South American business, for example, capital's not been easy because it's all been flowing to the United States. Raising funds through IPOs have not been easy because it's been flowing into the United States. Momentum tends to beget momentum because people, you know, look over there and, hey, my brother-in-law is doing this. And whether it's wise or not, they start chasing it, okay, until it actually collapses on itself. There are some ridiculously attractive investments, and you should talk to your advisor before you go out there, because I don't want to slip up and give a specific recommendation, but commodities in relation to U.S. assets. You know, they haven't given us an all clear buy signal at this point. We got a brief blurb of one, you know, coming out of the COVID bottom back in 2020, but then they have since fallen back off. We're back to this financialization again, right? But those are some of the most attractive assets, and they tend to be the assets, international assets. If you're a U.S. investor and your currency is collapsing, the more assets that you have in international currencies, hopefully the right one. You got to be in the right one, right? It's like a seesaw. Mm-hmm. So as U.S. currency is going down, the other currencies are going up in relative value, or they're all going down. One's going down slower than the other. But there are assets that are out there that you can protect yourself, but your traditional, what has worked over the next 20 years or past 20 years is not going to be the same thing that works over that period of time. Now, what I don't know is whether it's 3 months from now or 3 years from now. It's hard to imagine that it'll be, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, because I believe that we're very nearly out of runway. But the problem is, you know, the window is so blurry that you can't see the end of the window, but you can see all the signs out the side windows, which are as clear as they can be, that we're headed in that direction.
Well, you know, they say that they're worried about volatility returning to these markets, which is code speak for prices might go down, you know. That's what they mean. They don't care if they're volatile upwards. Volatility is a downward thing. Right. And I don't know, because, you know, I, again, not pulling politics here, but it's pretty clear to me that there's not a chance in the world Biden can make it through to the election. It's not clear to me that there is an obvious replacement that has been selected at this point within the DNC power structure. So this looks chaotic to me, potentially. Right. We're setting up for a period of uncertainty that could lead to volatility, which means prices go down. Right. And I don't know that we're totally ready for that at this point in the market structure. You know, it's because so much hinges on so few, the big seven we've been talking about, the big seven stocks, you know, it's all technology, you know. Hey, you had a chart on that, didn't you? Which just showed like how much concentrated firepower has gone into just technology as compared to every other sector out there?
Yes, bear with me. I'm trying to get there. I'm learning the.
That's fine.
That was Charlie Blow.
That one.
Albert Edwards, you know, and I looked at this. He always puts out good information. I had considered recreating this myself. I was like, nah, I'm going to give Albert Edwards credit for this. So outperformance begets outperformance. One of the things I was talking about a minute ago.
Wow, that's impressive.
Cumulative.
Look at that.
Global, Chris. This is global. Global sector flows over the last 12 months, weekly, in billions of dollars. So technology is in yellow. Look at that. Telecom, flat, it's up just a little bit. Industrials, somewhat positive, but consumer goods, utilities, materials, right? Inflation hedge, real estate. I get that a little bit. Real estate was in a bubble. Healthcare, financials. I get financials. I don't get energy at all. Look at that. The worst performing money flow has been energy compared to technology.
How about that? Now, this is astonishing to me because I posted this at my site a while back because I found a chart also on Twitter that showed that the current market cap of NVIDIA is now higher than the entire energy sector in the S&P.
It's worth more combined.
Yes. A company that makes little chips that goes into little boxes so that we can do some AI or whatever the narrative structure is worth more than the entire energy sector. This is all the coal companies, all the oil companies, all the gas companies, all of them.
Yes.
That's nuts.
You fill your tank every day to drive. Every shipment that comes to you has to have that energy produced. We have to have it to have this conversation and listen to it. But I don't have to go. I mean, don't get me wrong. NVIDIA chips are out there, but that just is representative of the boom that's taking place. So there are two periods of time in history, Chris, that I believe that remind me of the time that we're in. Okay, one is 1999. So in 1999, Warren Buffett, which is a legendary investor through Berkshire Hathaway, lost approximately 20%, somewhere between 19-20% in the year 1999. The S&P 500 was up 20% that year. NASDAQ was up a lot more. I just know the data on the S&P. But the technology stocks were just pulling, you know, internet, it's the new economy. You know, in the fear of the Y2K bug, you know, Greenspan had juiced the economy again, trying to make sure everything was okay. So investors were selling everything that Warren Buffett was buying. Buying and chasing all of these technology stocks. They just couldn't take it anymore, right? The herd just sucked them right in. Mm-hmm. Well, what was fascinating is from 2000 to 2003, the S&P 500 went down approximately 47%, and Warren Buffett went up approximately 40% in Berkshire Hathaway. I think it was 38.5, something like that. So what he was doing was buying everything that people were selling to chase. Yes, internet has changed the world in the past 24 years. Amazon has changed the world in the past 24 years. But investors were overestimating how quickly Amazon was going to take over. And when reality set in, you know, it was a long time before those investors got back to even. And in my experience of working with individuals, there are few people that are patient enough to sit there at a 50% decline and add to it for 14 more years. Because a lot of them, I mean, you got to think, a lot of investors accumulate the largest amount of their wealth right before they get into retirement. And by the time they get into retirement, you know, they're 75, 76, 77, and they're still down 50%, you know, over the past 12 years in investment. They're like, I'll go into something else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's just fascinating. The second period that reminds me is 1973. And I think we've talked about this before on the podcast, but Charlie Bolello pointed out in his weekly market date this week, we've been up 14 of the past 14 weeks in a row. In 1973, we were up 15 weeks in a row. Market kind of flatlined, had one little last gasp, and then inflation returned. And in 1973, we ended up with a recession and about a 47% decline in the market. Now, the stock market today is not prepared for that. The stock market does not anticipate that to happen, and I do believe it's a high probability. Now, like we've talked about before, we got to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us, okay? But our exits are very, very tight to the portfolios for anything that we own right now because of the fact that that risk is high, and we know we're not going to pick the top. But if this thing turns, it's going to go down very, very quickly. And if someone has not already prepared themselves to do what needs to be done and have those decision points in place, they're going to be like a deer in the headlights. And unfortunately be pushed into a position to where emotions can take over and they can make bad decisions at the worst possible time.
Yeah. Buying high, selling low. It's bad, bad habit, you know? Yeah. And I think it was Buffett, but somebody like him said, you know, you want to sell when people are greedy. You want to buy when people are fearful. You know, same sort of a thing. You just got to, Being in with the crowd is a dangerous place to be when it comes to investing, right? Mm-hmm. That's a thing, because by definition, the crowd always gets it wrong. Has to, you know, because by definition, it's not possible for everybody to get rich on investments. It's kind of a zero sum game in many respects, you know? And so we got to keep that in mind. Now, just to be clear before, I don't have a position in or really a position on NVIDIA. I was just pointing out that that's a marker for me that there's something wrong in this larger story. And it's not about NVIDIA per se. It's something wrong in investor perception when they're valuing this thing more than all the energy. Because you know what? We need energy, right? If somebody said, oh, all the gas stations are out of gas today, I'd be like, wow, this is a catastrophe. If somebody said NVIDIA can't ship chips for a month, I'd be like, you know? That's nothing right. happens to me. Nothing happens, right? So there's a big difference in those two things for me. And again, this is just perception, and it's this is why it's so important to study these things and to think about them and talk about them, because that's in my own world. You know, I'm not a great day trader or short term trader, but I'm pretty good at the longer trends. I sort of pick things, but you know, I do that I guess I'm a contrarian at heart. I love stuff when people hate them. You know, particularly if there are things I'm like, I know we need this, you know, I know we need this.
That's right.
You know, and there are specific things out there that I think are overlooked right now.
That's right. Well, in 2010, 2011, after the great crisis in 2008, you didn't have 50 bids on one house because it was fresh on the individual's mind about what real estate can do that actually can go down. Now there were a lot of people wiped out by that. The banks weren't as easy with credit, but the reality is there were still a lot of individuals out there who could have been euphoric in that manner. It's at the end of these long runs when you've had gradual increases and then these, you know, and that momentum feeds on itself to where everybody gets on the same side of the boat. Everybody convinces themselves. And then they look at those that are standing on the sidelines trying to be prudent and wise or contrarian, and they make fun of them and say, you are the crazy people. But yet, you know, it's fun while it lasts. You know, ignorance is bliss until you get hit in the mouth with a baseball bat. It really is. So
indeed,
enjoy that while it's can. And my encouragement to everybody that's out there is, you know, make sure you have an emergency fund. Make sure you have an emergency fund, because the high likelihood of a recession is coming. Take the opportunity. If you have some big gains in some of these individual stocks without naming names, peel a little bit off and build in an emergency fund. Okay. I would encourage people to consider getting out to 24 months right now because we have so postponed a recession. You know, worst case scenario, you've got it and you don't need it. But if we do have a recession, and let's say they kick the can down the road till after the election, or if it happens before, and there are mass layoffs and there's bankruptcies, and we finally have to pay the piper, right? If you've got a 24 months worth of emergency fund, you've got a better chance of keeping that home. You've got a lot less stress that's available to you. If you don't lose your job and you're 12 months into it, now that becomes opportunity money for you. You can draw that back down to about 12 months. Because, you know, the reality is for those that are prudent, and one of the things I love about the book of Proverbs is just the wisdom that lays out. You know, twice it tells us in the book of Proverbs, the prudent foresee danger and hide themselves while the simple pass on and are judged for it. So, my goal for clients is to be prudent, right? So they can enjoy their lives, help them prepare for those potholes. And Chris, you do such a great job of helping display wisdom to individuals and educate them so that they can be prudent. And the prudent thing to do right now is to prepare, you know, for the storm before it gets here, because that storm can arrive really, really quickly.
It sure can.
The undercurrent is right now.
It sure can. Very well said, Paul. So I would remind everybody that all of this was for educational purposes. If you want to talk to Paul, whose dance card is pretty full right now, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a very simple form, and we will be posting. We're in the process, Paul, now we're going to be posting all of these videos there as well as distributing them elsewhere. So there's a central repository for them there at that site. So with that, Paul, thank you so much for your time again today and your wisdom and for all the help you give to people that you can.
It's my honor, Chris. So, you know, my schedule is a little tight over the next week or so, but Dylan's wonderful. John's wonderful. As a team, we'll have a chance to work with you. So it's a short-term tightness because we had a lot of things there. A lot of great things happen. And so we look forward to the opportunity to serve and help you prepare and make a good plan.
All right. Well, thank you. Until next time,
we'll see you. Chris. Have a blessed day.
All right. Bye-bye. Hello, Chris Martinson. I'm the CEO of Peak Prosperity and also Peak Financial Investing. And after watching that, you're probably wondering, well, what do I do with my money? Look, you both deserve and need somebody who can talk to you about what's really going on in this world, understand the situation as it is, not be steering you towards certain things that don't make sense for you or just keep you in a game that's already ended. Look, if you want to talk to somebody about the petrodollar declining or what is happening with gold or which sectors are actually the best ones to be in, given what the Federal Reserve is up to or the federal government, you deserve to talk to somebody who can answer those and has a few gray hairs and has been there through some of the economic cycles because, hey, we're in another economic cycle. So it's good to have that experience. Fortunately, at Peak Financial Investing, what we do is we go out and we scour and we look for the very best firms out there who satisfy one thing above all else. They've got great experience coupled to great customer service. So if you want to come by peakfinancialinvesting.com, there's a very simple form you can fill out, just a few fields. You hit send. What happens is an email gets triggered out. It goes to an endorsed firm of ours. You will get an email back. You can then set up a phone call for a 30 to 45 minute free, no obligation, no pressure call to find out if this firm is a good fit for you and to find out if you're a good fit for the firm. It has to go both ways. And if all that matches up, this will be one of the best things that could happen to you this year. So please come by peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple process. We would love to help you if we can. Thanks very much.